We are continuing.
Michael, you two have to practice later.
Okay.
My neighbour has changed.
We are now continuing with the disclosure initiative materiality.
Okay. Thank you. Good afternoon, everybody. We're looking now at papers 2, 2A and 2B. And just to start with the introduction, materiality practice statement, we published a draft statement for comment in November with the objective that this draft, this practice statement would assist management in applying the concept of materiality to general purpose financial statements. But recognising that it could be helpful to users in understanding the process that has been followed by management, and also in response to concerns about the inclusion of immaterial information in financial reports contributing to disclosure overload and clutter. So with a goal to help identify immaterial information in order to exclude it, as well as making sure that all relevant material information was included in financial statements. Now, the practice statement, the draft practice statement, collates guidance on materiality from different parts of IFRS literature into one place. It doesn't propose any changes to the definition or to the existing guidance, but provides explanations on how to apply materiality together with examples. The proposal was that the practice statement would be non-mandatory and would therefore be facilitating the application of the existing guidance, so educational in nature. And this was done in part to reflect that education nature of the guidance, but also to avoid possible conflicts with local laws and regulations on materiality. The boards received 96 comment letters on the practice statement. Many of these agreed with the objective and the technical content, and also the proposed form of the guidance. What we've got today, though, we've brought to you is two papers. The first paper looking at some comments received from respondents on proposals in the practice statement to about identifying users, their information needs, and their expectations. And the second paper responds to a common request that a number of respondents made for more focus on the judgment process that is needed to be applied in applying materiality. And in response to that, we've developed a four-step approach, which we'll look at when we get to paper 2B. To start then with paper 2A, this paper sets out the comments that we received relating to expectations and user needs, and in paragraphs 9 to 21 of the paper summarises the link between materiality and primary users' needs and expectations, the different types or subsets of primary users, special needs of primary users that was identified in the draft practice statement, and primary users' expectations, including how primary users think the entity should be managed. We want to start off with the questions. So on page 12 of the paper, set out some questions here for you to get your advice on how we might respond to some of these comments that we received. So first of all, think about the differing information needs of different types of primary users. Several respondents agreed with the notion of identifying primary users' needs in order to assess what information is material. Some expressed the concern, though, that about the extent to which an entity is required to do this. And at the CMAC and GPF meeting that was held last month, some GPF members questioned what the starting point should be for an entity when undertaking its materiality assessment, and suggested that the requirements in IFRS standards should be the starting point for that materiality assessment. So in response to this feedback that we received, we're considering a two-element approach to identifying material information. The first element would be starting with the disclosure requirements that are set out in applicable IFRS standards, and that would be principally a quantitative assessment on the grounds that in identifying those disclosure requirements in an IFRS standard, the board has undertaken a qualitative assessment itself in considering the common information needs of a maximum number of primary users. So this first element would, we think, would result in identifying what the disclosure requirements set out in an applicable IFRS would be material for that entity and should be included, and similarly what could be excluded. Then the second element would be identifying additional information to meet the additional needs of all or perhaps a major subset of primary users, and in doing so the entity would need to consider both quantitative and qualitative characteristics of materiality in assessing that information. So turning to that first question, I wanted to ask for your thoughts, your views on that consideration that we have of including this two elements aspect to judging what is material in for financial statements.
Noble.
Yes, thank you. Before we get into the questions, I have a question for you. The proposal of the practice statement was written in the context of financial statements, and in this paper for this meeting, it all refers to financial reports, and we weren't sure if you actually expanded your scope or not.
Sure. No, good question, and it's something that we will bring to the board to specifically ask them about that, whether we should be focusing on financial statements or financial reports. The reason for using the term financial reports in the paper was because that's how it's described in the definition of materiality. But it is a valid question, and it is something that we will bring specifically to the board to discuss with them whether we should be having the broader financial reports or keep it narrower to financial statements.
Jim?
So I thought particularly the first step seemed much more concrete and useful in my mind. I struggle a little bit with the second step, and this is, I think, carried forward into the next paper, which is effectively the fourth step in the decision process, where in there it's even more concrete. It says whether you've disclosed all material information, which seems like a very broad sweeping statement. In many cases could be proprietary information that investors could find useful, isn't disclosed today, so things like forecasts of future revenues might be very useful, decision useful to investors. It's very related to an accounting topic. And if there's a broad statement that says you have to disclose all material information, I guess what would the bounds of that in fact be? Even things like on leases, you have a small ticket lease exception. Of course, that could aggregate to an amount that might be decision useful. Does that therefore override a decision by the ISB that says you don't have to track small ticket leases, but of course you may have a disclosure obligation if it's material to disclose those things? So the boundary of remuneration of individual executives might be decision useful to investors. Would this cover the pay? In the US it's to the top five executives, but why stop at five? Maybe an investor could find the pay to the sixth individual also useful. And so it seemed unbounded by anything other than if you think information about financial stuff could be decision useful, you have an obligation to disclose. And it at least seemed very broad and very sweeping. And I didn't have a suggestion of how to fix that. It's not the way I think I've traditionally thought about in the U.S. context. It's perhaps not as useful, but I think people start from the standpoint of the tick the box approach isn't useful either.
How about adding within the bounds of financial reporting requirements?
And even that, I think that's a good start. I think you can think about, well, is future revenue, you know, within the bounds or outside the bounds? It certainly goes into calculations of goodwill impairment.
I think it is worth saying that we do have some statements elsewhere that you probably need to read this in the context of. So if you look at some of the things that we're looking at in the conceptual framework in terms of looking at what is the purpose of, well, sorry, it's more in terms of the disclosure initiative, actually looking at what is the purpose of the primary financial statements, what's the purpose of the notes, what sort of information would be included. And I think one of the statements we've got in the conceptual framework that tries to put a boundary on the information that you would have in a set of financial statements, we talk about it being information about the existing assets and liabilities, income and expenses, and not providing information about those future items. So things like future projections of revenue would fall outside the scope of this.
Although that is included in a goodwill impairment test.
That's because it affects the existing assets and liabilities.
Right, so if you had goodwill, would you be required to disclose projections of future revenue? Or remuneration to individuals is an expense, so do you have to disclose remuneration to your top five employees? I think those are the difficult questions you're going to I think, encounter if you say all material information.
Mm-hmm. Kimberly.
Yes, overall, our focus of our outreach we conducted in New Zealand and Australia was more actually on the first point rather than the second, but I'll come back to the second. The first point about, while we agree that certainly IFRS is your starting point, obviously when the ISP puts together a standard, it thinks about what's likely to be relevant to meet the common information needs of users. But clearly that isn't a standard. A materiality itself is defined and explained in the conceptual framework as an entity-specific aspect of relevance. And so we were concerned by saying you should focus mainly on quantitative, because the ISP's already done the work for you on the qualitative side of things, might actually lead to not the outcomes you're seeking, because it might push people down that track of saying, for example, I've got a material amount of property, plant, and equipment. Well, that means I have to put every disclosure in that the ISB is listed in its standard, because you're assuming that they must be material. Whereas I think what we're trying to achieve with materiality is actually to think about, in my particular entity's circumstances, is it actually material? So we think that that's both a quantitative and a qualitative assessment consistent with the definition of materiality. So yes, a starting point, but you should always think about each one as is said in IS1 today. So we think that you should consider both factors. I think on the second element about standing back and saying, do I need to add anything? I guess we were looking at personal reaction to those concerns that Jim has raised. I guess is we already have a requirement in IS1 that tells you to do that. So clearly you need to put some boundaries around that, and I think in practice the reality is people do, once they've finished ticking their boxes, they do tend to get, oh, surely I've done everything I could possibly do. There is that sort of pushback if from adding anything extra. So obviously there do need to be some boundaries around that, but nevertheless it still is an existing requirement today.
Andrew.
A few comments. I must applaud the staff's efforts in trying to make the guidance more practical, and FAS is one of the organisations that's asked you to do that, so thank you again. That said, I think the board needs to be careful about creating artificially high expectations as to just how algorithmic, if you will, this is going to become. I mean, materiality is actually a pretty abstract concept and particularly challenging, I think, to apply to disclosures. There's just going to be an awful lot of judgment, and it's going to be hard to be very specific about exactly how that judgment should be taken. So overall, what I'd say, if you're going to create a judgment framework for disclosure, it's going to have to be painted in pretty broad strokes. Don't try and get down into sort of an artificial degree of precision. And I do wonder if talking about users and then particular subsets of users, with the implication that somehow they've got differential reporting needs, is in danger of going down a sort of artificial degree of precision route. In the end, I think when we think about materiality, we shouldn't have in our minds that information needs to be useful to all users to be material, but neither should we be thinking about the particular information needs of an individual user, which is kind of somewhere in the middle, and you can use different terminology to describe the somewhere in the middle idea. The two-element approach, when we...
Practical to me, Andrew.
Doesn't sound very practical. Well, actually, one...
You're just describing
a broad framework with some real-life case studies of how companies have actually travelled this journey. It looked at the overall effectiveness of their financial statements as a communication tool, which is partly about materiality, but partly about signposting and layout and placement and all that kind of thing. It's all part of a greater whole towards the overall objective, which I think is something, Hans, you've been talking about recently, communication effect might be practical. I'm not sure a step-by-step join-the-dots approach to materiality judgments is actually just going to be something you can create, to be honest. So in that sense, it won't be all that practical. But when we discussed this among our group, a couple of the preparers who've been down this journey did say they found the two-element approach quite intuitive. In other words, it's quite consistent with how they thought about it. But overall, we had more concerns than support. One of the concerns was having got through... this works almost like two filters. So the starting point, I think it should be, the information required by IFRS, but you need to be aware that the information required by IFRS for disclosure purposes is not an objectively definable information set, because disclosure requirements are increasingly expressed in an objectives-based way, which we support, and when it comes to disclosure, it isn't often a do we disclose yes or no decision, it's actually how much detail and how much emphasis you go into. So I think if you have in your mind an idea that you start off with, if you like, the total population of potential disclosures, in some ways you've already started in a difficult place, because there is actually no such thing, I don't think, no such thing you can objectively define. Then there were concerns that having kind of, if you do go down a filtering route, having filtered out the quantitatively immaterial of that potential information, so it actually, it's going to be in reality quite hard to get that back in step two. So I think what we're really saying here is think about a sort of somewhere in the middle between all users and individual user, and actually materiality involves a quantitative aspect and a qualitative aspect, and you can say it in different ways, but that's what we're saying.
Well, a question that I had when I started reading this paper was, and was it based on the comments that you'd received on the draft practice statement, was I think some people were of the view that you needed to identify the primary users of the particular entity and make sure that information was relevant to those users. And I think some of the examples that the comments that were submitted to say, well, you know, if you only had a single shareholder, and I think the tax authority was the only other user, you know, would that mean that you would then be, you know, excluding a lot of information that IFRS would otherwise require? So initially I was a bit concerned that, you know, were we going down the route of each entity identifying its primary users? And then of course, you know, there was a reminder to say that primary users are not just the current, you know, users or the current investors, but also potential investors, lenders, and creditors. So am I right in understanding that step one of the two-element approach is not requiring the entity to consider its primary users, as in it's that broad group of current and potential investors, lenders, and creditors, and that in setting the standards, the ISB has already determined what information is relevant to those broad groups of users, and therefore step one would simply be saying I need to start with that information, and I could consider excluding some information only on the basis of it quantitatively not being material, but I couldn't decide, well, actually, given the fact that, you know, I currently don't have any lenders, I don't believe certain information is therefore relevant because I don't have that sort of user group. Is my understanding correct that we're not going to expect or permit entities to effectively define what they think is relevant to their users?
That's right. And you've neatly picked up what the follow-on question from this section is, which is that exact example that you just referred to, where there may be some very limited, maybe only one existing investor, but as you say, primary users are defined as including potential investors. And therefore, what we're saying is that no, when you're looking at the disclosure requirements in order to identify what's material, you need to be thinking about not just existing but also potential investors, and that therefore you shouldn't be narrowing it to perhaps for some they may say an unusually narrow range of investors. Clearly, if that's what you've got, that's what you've got. And so what we wanted to sort of bring alongside this was some specific guidance in the practice statement to just make clear, look, you've got to think about potential investors as being part of your primary users. You therefore can't narrow it too much. And yes, so you identified or you focused on, does that mean then that the broad or the set of disclosure requirements that the board has already set out in IFRS standards, is that our starting point that is then principally a quantitative assessment, because we're saying, no, you can't look at your existing investors and narrow that set of disclosures down just because you've only got one investor being a parent company, for example.
I also think that, and also I see that reference is only made to potential investors. I mean, is that meant to, you know, include potential creditors and potential lenders? Or was it deliberate that we've only said it also includes potential investors?
That is certainly how I've read the existing literature. It talks about existing and potential investors, lenders, and other creditors. We've not, in this project, attempted to explore further whether the potential and existing adjectives relate only to investors or also relate to lenders and other creditors as well. I think that would be beyond the scope of what we're looking at here in terms of materiality.
Wouldn't it apply to those three? Whereas the wording in the paper seems to just talk about potential investors.
I think the way I read the conceptual framework language was that the existing and potential applied to all three.
Applied
to investors, lenders, and other creditors. I suppose Kim's question is whether you deliberately only referred to
potential investors,
or you were thinking about the broader.
No.
A bit of a shortcut for those three.
No, we weren't trying to change what's already there.
Okay, all right. So just coming back to your question, I mean, I certainly think that is helpful, because I do think that there were some concerns that, you know, entities were going to need to start with sort of a bit of a clean sheet of paper and define their users and able to say, no, well, I don't think my users are interested in that, and they won't find that relevant. So I certainly like the starting point. My only concern, I suppose, and I know you do say principally from a quantitative perspective, is, you know, something could be material, but from a qualitative perspective. So in other words, something might, you know, I was just saying, you know, maybe in a particular environment, maybe the CEO is not actually receiving a salary for whatever reason. But now, wouldn't that information actually be qualitatively, you know, material? Or maybe you might have an off-market transaction with a related party. So again, quantitatively, that's not material, but qualitatively it is. So, but I wasn't quite sure with the use of the word principally, it would mean that, well, you're not excluding a qualitative assessment, but...
Yeah, and it was to consider that there could be circumstances where there are qualitative aspects, and what you've just described, sort of transactions that are maybe at an off-market price and therefore at maybe a nil or close to nil value, we wouldn't necessarily want those to be excluded just because the value was so low. So therefore there would be a qualitative aspect needed for that assessment. And obviously what we'll need to do is to make sure that we pick that up and describe that in a way that's going to be useful for people. But predominantly, we saw this as being a quantitative assessment. And again, getting back to, you know, making it practical for people in applying the materiality guidance.
Linda.
Thanks. Just a couple of points from our perspective. So when we talk about the first element, that makes perfect sense to most people we've talked to, because you start with what you think is required, and you say, well, that's not material for my enterprise, so you would exclude that. Okay. Behaviorally, some of the research we're doing right now says that a lot of the smaller entities don't want to go through that work. They think that's more work to try to do that every year than it is just to blindly kind of repeat the required disclosures every year. It takes them more work to decide that it's not material. And so I would just urge you to kind of consider that behavioral impact and consider what happens around things like when you say it's immaterial this year, but it was material in the comparative year. And, you know, it changes year to year. So consider some of those behavioral aspects in terms of helping people do this. But generally, people say, well, if it's not material, okay, yeah, that makes sense. I would take it out. The other thing I wanted to comment on was, you say included in the financial report. I'm going to go back a little bit to what Jim said. In our jurisdiction, people would struggle with what that meant, the financial report. Does that mean the financial statements and notes? Does that mean, in our case, we have securities law required MD&A, so does that mean the whole report? Does that mean the investor presentation? Like, what? How big is that thing? Because that speaks to kind of the scope of all material information in the financial report. So in our jurisdiction, that would be read very literally, and we'd have people running all over the place trying to figure out what that meant from a scoping perspective. So I would just offer, you know, with those couple of comments, in addition to some of the things I've heard.
Thank you.
Thank you. The ALC members generally disagreed. Question one, regarding question one, the ALC members generally think that the two-element approach would be helpful. However, majority of the ALC members disagreed that the first element would be a largely quantitative assessment. They thought management should perform both the quantitative and qualitative assessment as the first element. One ALC member said that management should also consider the qualitative aspects of the items or transactions involved under certain circumstances, such as related party transactions under IAS 24 and the risk analysis under IFRS 7. One ALC member said that management should consider both the quantitative and the qualitative aspects when assessing the applicability of items in accounting standards because materiality is entity-specific relevance. And one ALC member thinks that the main objective of the two-element approach is to identify primary users and their information needs. And therefore, the two-element approach would be step one of the four-step approach. Management will then perform both the quantitative and the qualitative assessment in information identified in step one to see what information is material. That is step two.
Patrick.
I have to say I am careful about a two-step approach in terms of materiality, because I think that financial statements and financial information has to be taken from an objective perspective, and there is, to a certain extent, materiality that is designed for all users. I am careful about trying to distinguish categories. This is a problem that has been identified in the dissemination of financial information in general. So in this case, I suspect it would be included in the financial statements as presented, so I think it would be public for the companies that are public, which is, of course, most of the users, the preparers using IFRS and the users contemplating those financial statements. However, I think it's always difficult to have, a level of drilling down that differ and that puts the emphasis on a category of users. So I would prefer a more objective approach in general that would, I put the emphasis on a more objective approach that is acceptable for everybody, rather than after a standard level say, oh, by the way, I need to put something for Mr. X or Mr. Z or whoever it is. I'm careful with about the two-step approach. Jen?
Thank you. We have some comments on the second element. First one is that we are a little confused by the wording, such as additional information needs of primary users or a particular subset of primary users. What is a particular subset of primary users? Although in this paper you provide some examples, but it's still difficult for the preparers or the standard setters or other users to know how to identify the particular subset of primary users. It seems like that we have a primary users which is defined in the conceptual framework is already right, but we have a particular subset. How to identify this subset of primary users? That's the first point. The second point, is about the scope of the project. Let's think about the objective of the materiality project. I think in the past discussion, in my opinion, this project should focus on the application issue of materiality within the IFRS requirement. But it seems that according to this paper, you said the entity should satisfy the primary users. And if they have additional needs for information, the entity should satisfy them. If that is the case, that means the preparer should provide more and more information than ever. That's some concerns from the from some Chinese constituents. That's the direction, which direction we should go forward. Because in the conceptual framework ED, the paragraph OB8, you said focusing on common information needs doesn't prevent the reporting entity from including additional information that is most useful to a particular subset of primary users. From this sentence, our understanding is that the if some additional information is useful for the user, the IFRS doesn't prevent them to do so. But from the paper to the paper 2A, it seems that the direction is different. We should provide, we should satisfy the needs, information needs of the users if they need more. That's the first comment on the element, the second element. Another one is we should think about the scope of the project, because the all the IFRS is focusing on the general purpose financial statement, right? So when we when we are talking about this project, we should think all the requirement in IFRS already requires at least disclosures that meet the common needs of primary users. So in our opinion, we are wondering whether it's necessary for the entity to provide additional information just to satisfy some a particular subset of users. That's our concern.
And you pick up on this topic of subsets of primary users, which was another element of the questions that we had for you today. And the draft practice statement talked about identifying different types or groups of primary user and what their different information needs might be. You've highlighted quite nicely, I think, that OB8 talks about subsets, but in the context of essentially sort of additional information or optional information almost that could be given, whereas the practice statement talked about it more in terms of needing to give in order to meet the broad information needs of significant or larger groups of subsets of primary users. What we had in our analysis in this paper, what we had focused on was in order to try and strike the balance, as we saw it, between meeting the information needs of particular primary users and the sort of the much more general wider needs of primary users, that if we're going to be looking at and suggesting that preparers identify different types of primary users, then that really ought to be focused on significant subsets of primary users and not going down into individual primary users. Hence our third question here was about asking you if you thought it would be helpful to identify subsets of primary users and whether that should focus only on major subsets and their additional common information needs as a group. Or do you think that we should be moving away now from that idea of different types of primary user and not considering that? As I say, our staff proposal is that we would stick with some degree of proposing that you identify subsets of primary users, but that the focus should be on sort of significant subsets. So particularly interested to follow up on the comments from Chen Yu and to see what others have to say on that topic.
I certainly hope that those companies won't have these endless discussions about who their primary users are as we always do. Andreas.
I must say I'm highly concerned about this direction of travel, because I think we run the danger of moving into exactly the opposite direction that I thought this project was going, which was to single out the information that's material and doing away with superfluous stuff. I think if we now try to search for people who would be interested in more information, I think we run the risk of doing exactly the opposite. I would have exactly the same question as Eugene in saying, how do these proposals resonate with general purpose financial statements? I mean, we are heading down the way and saying, single out a particular user for whom something might be interested, and that obviously is even more important if we go beyond financial statements and go to financial reports. Is it in the previous ASEP meetings in Europe, currently we implement the CSR directive, and that would have an impact on the equivalent of your MD&A report. So where does that stop? I mean, the primary user for a carbon disclosure is certainly not the key financial statement person, but certainly a primary user for that type of information. So I think we need to be cognizant and hold back, really. If there is extra information that needs to be given to a certain constituency, I think it has to be done outside of financial reporting, really.
Everybody is enthusiastic about this. Subscribe.
So I just kind of build on what Andreas is saying and ask you to think about this from a scoping perspective, because I agree that, I mean, we're standard setters and we're focused on financial reporting. So we've got to keep that in mind. And then there are securities regulators who give guidance as well. So an example of what you're talking about could be, for instance, during the financial crisis, banks were asked to do more disclosures. There was the Enhanced Disclosure Task Force. There was other Financial Stability Board stuff. There were prudential regulators wanting certain things. And I remember going through that, and some of it was required, you know, in some of the risk disclosures and IFRS 7, et cetera. But what you did is you said, okay, I've already got this, I've got to add this to it, and then everybody wanted it to be audited. So that would be an example where you had regulators, but they were doing it on behalf of investors, et cetera, saying, I want this new kind of disclosure, I want the same kind of disclosure you've been giving in much more detail. And then the entity would say, well, it only makes sense to build it into our process because then we can get the auditors to look at it, we have assurance around it, we have the governance of the audit committee and the board, et cetera. So that would be a live example where you've identified some other users, but you still got scope around it. If you don't have scope around this, then the people trying to prepare these financial reports, again, please define the financial report, they're not going to know exactly where they're supposed to begin and end with all this additional information. So scoping is a big thing here, depending on how you choose to approach this.
Kimberly?
Well, I echo, I guess, a lot of the comments that have been made about the focus on the subsets. We had similar reactions in that people were saying, well, we're supposed to be focusing on common information needs, and this focus on subsets seems to be taking us down a special purpose reporting as opposed to general purpose reporting. And I think, you know, certainly echo the comments around there's a difference between the conceptual framework saying not preventing adding additional information and turning it around and suddenly requiring it. Because if I think back to when that wording was created, it was focusing on not ruling things out if people did want to, and I guess the example that Linda just gave is an example of where you might end up adding something, but that wouldn't necessarily be a requirement in other circumstances. So we did have concerns around this, and I think if you're going to talk about subsets, it would have to be done in the context of helping you identify the common information needs of primary users. If you happen to have like a big chunk of one particular type of users, then maybe it helps you to think about that particular type when you're identifying common information needs, but it still has to be, I think, in the context of general purpose information meeting common information needs.
Alberto?
I simply want to join the camp of those who are highly concerned about this project, because especially for us in Italy, we live in a very litigious environment, and this is an invitation for any shareholders claiming to have a right, inverted comma, right to have information which are useful to him, and, you know, and generally speaking, it's not just one. He may claim that it is a subset of users interested only in a specific aspect of the business of the company, but still they want this information. They don't find it in the financial statement. They file a claim that financial statements are incomplete or whatever, and so the matter goes on and on in front of a tribunal. I'm highly concerned about this.
Jim?
Just to be incremental, concern about trying to distinguish between major subsets of primary users and minor sets of primary users. If you have the term primary user and observe that primary users can be, you know, different things, they could be equity investors, they could be debt investors, they could be potential investors, but then trying to distinguish amongst those which are primary
and major and primary and minor, I think gets to a level that probably actually adds confusion as opposed to clarity. One of the terms, at least in U.S. security law, is a reasonable user or reasonable investor. Maybe that captures some of this notion, is that we're not. I don't. They're all over the place, but we're not looking for the tail on either end.
Whoever is investing is unreasonable.
We're not looking for the investor who's only doing technical analysis, somebody who's actually using the financials. And on the other hand, we're not looking for the investor who, says, well, I can drill down to the 800th layer of analysis.
The reasonably uneducated investor.
Patrick?
It's already difficult to define primary users, and you have different views about that. Because, by the way, what is being said is that potential investors, reasonable or not, are the primary users, but the information for them may serve other populations of interested parties. At least that's my understanding. And under certain jurisdictions, it's very important to have a broader spectrum. The financial information should satisfy a broader spectrum of parties, interested parties. So I think that, it's already difficult on primary users to complexify the issue by adding subsets. Seems, for me, the a la carte idea of financial information is a very dangerous ground. That being said, if we are talking about something else, which is additional information outside financial information, that's different, because information can be derived from financial information that is needed for, I don't know, royalty purposes, whatever. You may have a number of expectations from subgroups, but that has to be dealt with outside the scope of financial information and within the boundaries of what is, the limits of information that can be given to parties if the companies are, the entities are listed. Because that's something where you cannot trespass, or you find yourself in the position that Alberto was describing.
Okay, well, actually, this enthusiastic
it's very helpful. It gives us a very clear steer.
British understatement.
Okay, so now, so the next paper.
We've just got one more point on this paper 2A, and that's the term expectations, and you picked up on it, I think, a little bit already, and really just wanted to ask if there was anything further you wanted to add to that. And that is the term expectations was used in the draft practice statement in a way that is different from how it's used in the conceptual framework. And some certainly took this as meaning that we needed to get into the minds of the users in order to determine what their expectations are and therefore what information should be provided in the financial statements. Now, from what you've said already, suggests that you would be sort of moving away from, or encourage us to move away from, that sort of use of the term, which is what we're proposing as well. But really just wanted to ask if you had any further comments regarding the use of the term expectations.
I'd support reducing the use of the term expectations in this context. Of course, PERA shouldn't need to get into the minds of users because the ISB has already done that. I do think to do a meaningful job of using materiality as part of a greater goal of communication effectiveness, you have got some insight into whether your primary users, have we put boundaries around that, have got some particular interest in particular areas and less interest in others. Otherwise, in the end, what are we really saying here? But so getting into the minds of does seem like a step too far.
Okay, thank you. So, yes, we'll move on now to paper 2B, and Aisling's going to take us through that.
A four-step approach, of which one would probably be deleted the first one. Okay, you go ahead, Aisling.
Okay, so we have already touched on the four-step approach, so I'll just go through the paper quickly and then we can start discussing it. But one of the main themes that we heard from the feedback from the exposure draft was that there was a need to focus more on the practical application of materiality. We did hear from a lot of respondents that they appreciated that we had brought together the current guidance on materiality, and that was useful, but that we needed to delve down further and describe the process that was used and to make it much more practical. So this paper is part of our response to that, and we'd like to hear your thoughts on it. The application of materiality is part of preparing financial reports or financial statements, and in developing this four-step approach, we demonstrate the role that materiality plays in putting these financial reports together. So just quickly, the four steps are, the first step is identifying the primary users and their information needs, which we've discussed at length. Step two is assessing whether the particular pieces of information about the entity's financial performance and their financial position are material, and this is in the context of the financial statements. Step three is organising this material information within the financial reports, and then step four is stepping back and reviewing the financial or the draft financial report to assess whether all of the material information has been included, which we've touched on, and whether any information has been duplicated, and considering the cumulative materiality of some information that may have been discarded in step two. So just to give a little bit more detail, I don't think we need any more detail on step one, but step two is about the materiality judgment itself. So when making this judgment, management need to consider the user information needs, but also the broader environmental factors. And this can be a whole range of things. This could be the entity's industry, macroeconomic environment, the climate change environment. So we've put together a diagram which describes some of the considerations that management could take into account. And that can be seen on page 6 of paper 2B. And they're basically broken down into quantitative factors, entity-specific qualitative factors, and environmental factors. So then step 3 deals with how we organise the information that we've decided is material. And management needs to decide, does this need to go on the face, on the notes? And then if it is going in the notes, what order do we put it in the notes? And materiality is definitely one of the factors that management used to make this decision, but there are other factors, and these factors are being dealt with as part of the principles of disclosure paper or discussion paper that's going to be published later this year. So we haven't gone into that in too much detail. And then step 4 is really about stepping back and reviewing the draft. And this is based on their cumulative knowledge and their experience of the entity, and they must assess whether all the material information has been included, whether it's been given the appropriate prominence, and it's really an opportunity to step back and consider the cumulative materiality of information. So we want to hear your views on whether you find this useful, whether it's responding to the calls for making the process more, or the guidance more practical. So I suppose if we just go through the questions. The first question is, do you think that more guidance is needed? And if so, what would this guidance say?
Andreas?
When reading this, I was wondering how much, because you said that people were asking for more guidance as to the process, how much they really meant the process or the execution of the process. Because I thought the devil is really in step two. How do I make that judgment? I think the sequencing is nice and explains that the process probably doesn't stop at stage two, but there are adjacent layers that you need to consider. I think that's helpful. But the key question, I think, that I hear at least, always comes down to how do I do this? So I think what could be helpful to consider is to have some examples run through your model. And so do develop an example and show how you apply steps 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. You've done that in part by including the EG, for instance, but I would do that in real life cases, and I would pick specifically at least one borderline case where it isn't that obvious, because the obvious ones we never challenge, right? Mm-hmm. It's always borderline cases as to am I in, am I out, and better be safe than sorry, and yeah. But really, if you want to add value, I think that would be helpful.
Thanks. Yeah, I certainly share Andreas's comments. The other question that I had was how this four-step approach ties back with the two element we just spoke of, because to me, I guess step one and step two here, isn't that the two element approach that we actually just spoke of? Because otherwise step one says identify the primary users, and going back to my comment I made earlier, we're not expecting the entity to go and define its primary users and their information needs and all of that. So I actually thought that the two-element approach would have been the starting point and not the step one we have here.
Yeah, I think we'll end up sort of pushing these together. The four-step approach is reflecting very much what is in the draft practice statement and a sort of describing the approach that is set out in there. What we talked about just now and the two-element approach was sort of questioning or challenging what we had in the draft practice statement in terms of identifying user needs. Which is a change, or could be a change to what we had exposed, and therefore will need to be incorporated into this four-step approach. So, fair question, and we will need to push these two together.
Because I would have thought then on step two in this four-step process, the whole judgment process, I mean, isn't that what we just spoke about being principally quantitative in the two element approach? Or is this now, as I say, the intention meant to be a bit of an expansion of the step one, yeah, in the first or the first element in the two element approach?
Yeah, so the actual on the four step approach that we have here, as Andreas rightly pointed out, you know, questioned, you know, are people asking for the process, yeah, or the sort of judgments? And, you know, it arguably is just step two is what they were asking for. Right. But because of the fact that we think that when you get to step four, you've got to think about it again, we didn't want to lose that. We wanted to capture that element of sort of circling back into it. So hence the fourth step. But in terms of making the judgments themselves, which is, I think, what the people's main request was for this second step, which is that where we've then focused in on, well, what are the factors that we think that people should be thinking about and applying in making the decision? Because for a particular piece, a given piece of information, it's either material or it's not material, or is that's the judgment that's being asked of them. But we're saying, look, there are a number of factors that you're going to need to consider here to make that particular judgment on a given piece of information.
Okay, so this needs to be considered in the context of bringing,
yeah,
the previous paper together.
We'll need to do that, then. Yes.
But I certainly think that, yeah, some actual examples, because I think that's what people are asking for. I don't think they're asking for more concepts. Mm-hmm. I think they're asking, say, practically,
yeah,
how do I actually do this? So, yeah.
Linda?
Thank you. So I was happily able to ignore the other paper while I read this paper. Maybe that was just convenient. And I liked a lot of this paper because it reminded me quite a bit of what I used to do, mm-hmm, the way I thought about financial statements. So under box one, I would have done that slightly differently. Instead of saying identify primary users' information needs, I would have been focused on required disclosures. And I would have thought about that in three ways. I guess I should be careful about the use of the word required, but first of all, I would have thought about the standards required disclosures. Mm-hmm. And those would have been slotted into either what goes on the face of the statements in our parlance versus the notes, okay? Then I would have thought about the securities law disclosure. Then I would have looked for overlaps, because early on we had some big overlaps between our securities law disclosure requirements and some IFRS 7 disclosure requirements, and having them in both places just was not helpful to the users of our financial statements. It was just duplicative. And then I would think about, in balance, am I hitting everything I should hit? So there was actually a little element, is there anything else that I should put into these financial statements? So that would have been my step one. Step two would have been assessing materiality. And then leading into step three, I would have said, well, what was new and different this year that was really material? And I reordered the notes. And I have to tell you, I reordered the notes virtually every year. And so I don't know why people say you can't do that under current IFRS, because there's a bunch of Royal Bank statements that are audited that are in trouble if you can't do it. But anyway, because I did it. So I would look for prominence. I would say, I think this is still important enough, but it's not as important as it was a couple years ago, so I'm going to shift it to the back of the notes, and I'm going to shift this stuff forward so that logically, as people were going through the notes, they got the idea of prominence. And then I went off after all this was happening in production, and I got very near the final version, and my staff hated it because I'd disappear for a day. And they knew that when I came back, I'd have a boatload of changes. So I did this and say, okay, is this good enough? So I liked this in terms of practical guidance, other than I put a slightly different twist on, I mean, I didn't spend a lot of time trying to figure out new information needs, quite frankly. I had a ton of old information needs. So, but I did think about the things that had happened during the period, and was I making sure that they made their way into this set of financial statements.
Andrew?
Yeah, I like this as well. I think FRAG suggested a 5-step approach, so I could give this 4 out of 5. Anyway, I found this helpful. I think clearly step two is the heart of the overall paper, but putting this into a broader context is helpful. I do think the flow chart is on page 6 of paper 2b that supports step two. I was struggling to see how that was consistent with the two-element approach in paper 2a, and also noted that we do seem to be getting pulled back into reading the minds of our primary users by considering materiality in the context of users' expectations for profits and revenues and that sort of thing. So I just think that needs some probably drafting attention. And I just want to comment on step four, the step back, because I agree I think that's particularly important. I think the way step four is described, it does acknowledge you might actually, notwithstanding what you concluded in step two, you might actually remove some information by taking an overview of the financial statements, and I think you definitely need to have the capacity to do that. It's not just going to be removing information, it's looking at the overall statements and deciding that actually some particular point is duplicated or overemphasized in the context of that entity's story for that year. So you're going to provide less detail, more aggregation perhaps on that particular item, but I just encourage as rich a discussion of step four as possible.
So,
thank you. The OCG members generally expressed the view that the four-step approach will help management, but they suggested that the ISB provide more detailed guidance. A member recommended that the ISB add the following guidance in the proposed four-step approach, like how should management consider aggregating and disaggregating information in the financial statements in step three. They think that the ISB can consider the guidance in paragraphs 37 to 39 of the exposure draft in this area. And how management should assess whether the financial statements include all material information and give a balanced picture of the entity's financial performance and financial position in step four. Examples can be provided to illustrate, such as information appears to be immaterial individually, but material collectively when assessing together with other information in the final statements. And information appears to be material individually, but immaterial to the final statements as a whole. And another member also asked for providing illustrative examples for applying the four-step approach. Thank you.
Jim.
Similar to my concern about all material financial, or all material information, not even financial information, although I assume if this was filled out, it'd be in the context of financial information, and then scope of financial report versus financial statements, that seems, again, exceedingly broad in terms of its potential scope. And I wonder if an alternative might be taking a step back and identifying whether any additional material information is needed to comply with the disclosure objectives in IFRS. So now you actually have that bounded by a scope that says, look, if you're not meeting, and presumably as standard setters, writing a disclosure objective with respect to each standard ought to tell you what it is the standard setter thinks is the objective of that standard and its disclosure, and is there any material information that's missing that would be needed in order to meet that disclosure objective. That might be a more concrete way to get arms around what the scope of the required disclosure is.
Kimberly.
I guess that the feedback we had when we looked at this is weren't overly enthusiastic as a process, and I think it comes back to Andreas's comments around judgment versus process, because it kind of read like a mixture of those two things, almost like a beginner's guide to preparing a set of financial statements, which sort of seemed a bit simplistic when you have people talking about would you really do step two before step three, because step two says you evaluate it in the context of the financial report as a whole, but you don't, haven't done that whole bit until you got to step three. And other people talking about, you know, it's an iterative process because you've got lots of people involved in the financial statement production process, you know, more junior people and then more senior people, and the auditors come along and have their views around it, and also the process will differ depending on whether the company's already been through a streamlining process. So we have lots of companies in Australia and New Zealand that have already been through a streamlining process and created their new templates based on what is going to be material for the common types of information that they have. And so their annual process is more of a what's new or different this year, as opposed to starting from scratch all the time. So as a process, we didn't necessarily find it helpful, but we did think that in looking at the page 6, when it had some of those factors that you were thinking about, again, not as a process, but as some factors, some of the things that were talked about in there that we did think were helpful things for people to consider when they're applying that judgment. So if those notions are actually in the practice guide itself as factors to consider, rather than something that you step through, then we think that would be helpful.
Further questions? Or?
So I think that kind of answers the second part.
I
of
think
the part
so,
one.
So yeah.
Just part two, do you think that the draft four-step approach helps management to identify immaterial information and exclude it? So I suppose it's been kind of touched on before. Does anyone have anything to add?
That is not the case. Okay, thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
I propose we take a short break, like 10 minutes, 25 to 4, and then we continue with
OG.
I wasn't counting.
Five probably tough.